Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here through the hour to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Would you like to talk with Zorba? Here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. Some interesting research during the hour, Zorba?
Yes, we're going to talk about old age. In other words, how much are we aging in our society? And how do we get good quality aging as we get better? How do we keep from becoming disabled? And is there a ceiling on the age effect of modern technology?
The focus will be on me.
That's right.
During
we'll
that,
be on Tom and
research.
Making sure that Tom stays alive for at least the end of the show.
What else?
Male circumcision may reduce the risk of HIV, so we'll talk about circumcision. Always a hot topic.
Yeah.
In America.
Okay, that'll be coming up. And a yummy recipe.
Garlic, mustard, potatoes. I like all three words. I like the word garlic. I like the word mustard. And I love the word potatoes.
And you'll want to stick around for the medical myth buster as well. Here's that number again, 800-462-7413. Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener now in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
We appreciate the call. How can we help you?
All right. We've always tried to conserve energy, but I have a problem where energy conservation and health meet. We used to keep the thermostat at 72 in the day and 68 at night, and gradually we moved it down, so it's 66 in the day and 59 at night.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that our granddaughters are coming for a visit, and I'm concerned about what temperature is healthy for them to sleep at night. The littlest one is 2, and she tosses and turns all night. And, you know, she sleeps in one of those little fuzzy sleepers, but I don't want her to be cold.
You don't want her to be cold. I love it. She sleeps in a little fuzzy sleeper. You know, well, let's go back to the, you know, let's go back 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you look from a sleeping point of view, certainly in the state of Wisconsin and Minnesota, people used to sleep upstairs and there was no heat upstairs. They used to be under blankets and
right.
There'd be whatever heat was in the first floor of the farmhouse sort of leaked upstairs. And generally upstairs, I mean, I can remember I had a friend who had an old farmhouse and sleeping upstairs in his farmhouse, and I'd wake up, you know, in the nighttime or in the morning, and I would, you know, blow out into the air, and I remember it was so cold that I could, you know, could see the smoke in the air, you know, like you did as a kid when you went outside in the northern climes. So really, it's a matter of how warm they are when they're sleeping. You know, putting them in a double sleeper and putting them in a warm blanket, 59 is certainly not too cold. A lot of times you go out camping and you know, you're in weather that is lower than that. So they'll be healthy. Now, whether they'll be happy is something completely different, and that's a different issue. What about your daughter or your son?
They live in Tennessee now, and they keep it considerably warmer.
Yes,
wears long underwear in our house.
She wears long underwear in your house.
Yeah.
So do you think, is this an attempt not to have them come and visit you, or is that what this is all about?
Oh, no. We'd love to have them visit. I'm just worried about her little hands getting cold.
But kids sleep through pretty much any. I mean, then once they go to sleep, they tend to sleep well, as opposed to older people.
Look, her fingers aren't going to fall off. She's not going to be frostbite, and she'll be just fine at 59. The issue is whether or not, you know, if the family is huddling around the kitchen table and half the people are shaking, you know, while they're huddling around the kitchen table, and let me bring you a warm drink, and meanwhile, you and your husband are, you know, around in shorts around the house, so you're used to it. I think that's about it. Have you thought about turning up the heat in the house when they come?
Oh, sure. Well, but I just didn't know. You know, we're trying to conserve.
Oh, but you know
energy,
it's 5 days. You know, it's 5 or 7 days. You know, so
wait a minute. Why turn the heat? It's her house.
And it's her house. It's her house.
What's comfortable for you?
That's right.
It'll teach them a good lesson. Conserve energy.
Conserve
wear a sweater.
And shake. You'll have to serve them more food because when they're shaking to bring up their body temperature, they're going to burn some more calories. High fructose corn.
They're in Tennessee. They're visiting you in Madison, Wisconsin. They should learn to toughen out just like the rest of us in Madison, Wisconsin.
Well, that's true, but Sheely has she's 75% in height and only 25% body weight.
Oh, that's going to be just it. That's right. She has no meat on her bones.
That's,
you know,
right,
thin people are so cold at night. That's why we in the state of Wisconsin, Minnesota, are
person?
So heavy.
Am I in Wisconsin?
Put on that fat in order to maintain our body temperature.
Okay. Well, anyway, what are you going to do?
You're suggesting I turn up the heat.
Well, that's
temperature.
That's a possibility. Or give them gloves when they come in the house.
Yes.
That's a little gloves for little kids, big gloves like that. Gloves and warm liquids. That's right.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Sure. Where do you keep your thermostat at, Zorba?
Zero. We keep them at zero. 32 degrees in the house,
no,
just above
zero.
Freezing.
Oh,
and therefore, what do we keep in our house? We sleep at night at like 66, 67.
67?
I like
that's
cold
too
night.
Warm.
What? Too warm. Why? What do you keep yours at night?
59.
Oh, gosh. Really? No, you don't keep
yours. Yes.
59?
Of course.
Oh, that's way too cold.
You got a quilt on the bed.
Yes, I do have a quilt on the bed.
You're not running around naked in the middle of the night.
Well, I don't know.
Maybe you are running. Anyway.
I'm running around naked in the middle of the night. My wife, Penny, would never, 59 would be way too cold for her. I mean, she likes it. Her mother kept the temperature at about 86 during the daytime in the house, and cold for her was 75. So when I would go to the house, it was terrible. We'd try to go to sleep at 75.
Oh,
so we'd go into the back room of the house and open up the windows. Because it was like a 70, you know, once it got below 75, they shook. Oh.
Interesting. 800-462-7413. Talking about old people and aging, we have research on that.
Well, there may be a ceiling on aging, and it's interesting. You know, I mean, I wrote a book on longevity called, you know, How to Live a Long, Sweet Life,
right.
You know, with the longevity code. And the issue is there a ceiling on life expectancy? And the
experts... You mean we've been getting older and older and older, and maybe this won't continue forever.
Well, it won't continue. The real issue is a lot of our increase in age for our society comes from infant mortality. Since around 1950, death rates among infants have plunged 76%. In other words, the number of infants from 1950 to the year 2000 who are surviving is 75% greater, which is really a lot. Most infants survive, but you look at the ones who died, you know, we're able to save them.
As our prenatal care has gotten better.
Our prenatal care, you know, how we're essentially feeding and treating infants, you know, giving them antibiotics, immunizations, huge increase in the number of infants and number of kids who survive to the age of 5 and 10.
So when we hear year after year that the average death is 65,
right.
70, 71.
It's really from the fact
so
that
those of us who are approaching that can't think, oh, good, I'm going to live longer.
But if you look from mid-age people, the age of 50 on, there also has been a dramatic increase. When you look from the age 60 on, it's not as dramatic, but you look at the age 50, there's been an increase of about 10 to 15 years from people who are 50 on because of less smoking cigarettes, wearing seatbelts, better cardiac care, drop in blood pressure and stroke. But if you look at disability, there's been an amazing drop in people 65 and older. When Ronald Reagan was president, roughly 35% of the people 65 and older were disabled in one major aspect of their activities of daily living. That has now dropped below 20% down to about 18%. So in other words, not only are we living longer for mid-age people to some extent, but we are less disabled. That's a biggie.
Yeah, but those of us who are getting on...
don't expect much. Don't expect much. Once you're 65 or 70, don't
and
expect
much. And a decade from now and 2 decades and 4 decades from now,
don't expect much.
Increasing
that much. But, people said that in the 1890s. One major and important issue is this. If you smoke cigarettes and you're at the age of 20, you have the same longevity in the year 2006 as you did in the year 1880. In other words, cigarette smoking wipes out 100% of the increase in longevity if you're 20 years of age and older. That's what it does. So if you're the age of 20 and you're a smoker, it's the same as a non-smoker in 1880. That's basically what it is. So smoking wipes it out completely.
Obesity, not the same?
Well, nobody knows how much obesity wipes it out. Nobody knows. We know that there's an increase in diabetes and other issues, but nobody knows. And a lot of the epidemiologists think it'll drop it off a lot. I'm sure it will, but nobody knows precisely.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. A listener with us now, Zorba, in Salt Lake City. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
We appreciate it. How can we help?
Well, my question for you is about body composition and metabolism. I've read a few different ideas, and I'm not sure which one is correct. Basically, one is that the more lean muscle mass you have, the higher your metabolic activity. So if you lost 5 pounds of fat and gained 5 pounds of muscle, you would require more calories each day. But on the other hand, I was told by a biochemist that there's no evidence for that idea and that all tissues have the same calorie requirements. And so I was wondering, if you lost weight and put on muscle mass, would you require more calories?
Well, the issue with muscle mass and fat mass is interesting. People who have more fat mass do less. I mean, we know statistically, if you're overweight and obese, you don't do as much. You, for the most part, not everybody, but you tend to be a couch potato, so you don't do much. And people who have a lot of lean body mass tend to do more. So we know statistically, people who have more muscle compared to fat exercise more, and of course, that's one reason that they have more muscle and compared to fat. You know, it's a chicken and kind of egg sort of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
From a metabolic point of view, in when you're resting, I don't know if there's that much of a difference between the resting metabolic needs. You know, you're sitting on a couch, you're doing nothing, and you take a pound of muscle and a pound of fat. I don't know if there's a difference in the resting metabolism between a pound of muscle and a pound of fat. I don't know if there's any evidence, nor do I really know if there have been any biochemical studies, and somebody will write in, I'm sure, if there have been, between a pound of muscle and a pound of fat at rest doing nothing. But once you start to move, the muscle uses more energy because it's moving.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really one of the issues on why we find that thin people tend to have a higher metabolism is often thin people have a higher muscle mass and they're doing more in our society, and heavy people tend to do less. So that's really the issue, is active energy is the thing that makes a difference, and fat does not burn as much as active muscle in use, because active muscle in use is in use. It's using more energy.
Yeah. And let me guess that our Utah caller is a medical professional of some sort, or?
Yes, I'm a medical student.
A medical student?
Oh, you're a medical student.
It sounds like a very informed question. That's
it. Sounds like a very informed. So, and basically, now if you look at medical students as a group, they tend to have lean muscle mass. They don't smoke cigarettes. They're actually a pretty healthy lot. I look at my daughter who's in medical school at the UW, and I look at her friends. They're a pretty heavy lot, except on Saturday night when they may go out and party, in which case they're not engaged necessarily in healthful activity. But lean muscle mass in action will burn more energy than fat in action, because fat doesn't do much in action. It doesn't do anything in action at all, and that's really where that issue is. So,
well, that makes sense.
So, mm-hmm. Which is good. So, what year are you in medical school?
I'm a third year.
A third year medical student. So, how do you like it?
Great. I really like it. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's fun. After your second year, when you're actually helping people, it's really fun stuff to do.
Right.
So, well, good luck. Enjoy medical school and get some sleep.
Thanks for calling us. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And a listener with us now, Zorba in Spokane, Washington. Hi.
Hello, doctors. Good to be able to talk with you.
Dr. Singular and Stooge. What's up?
Stooge.
Well, I should actually sign myself as stuffed up in Seattle. That's the basic problem. The specific problem is when I bend over to pick something up, it feels like my ear fills up with water. And haven't been in the shower when it happens, but I've had a rather interesting trip through three different ear, nose, and throat clinics trying to solve the problem.
Uh-huh. So you went to three different ear, nose, and throat clinics, and what did they say?
Well, the first fellow said that there was nothing wrong with me and hinted about that it was basically psychological. So I found myself another clinic. And every time I
you found yourself another clinic.
Yes.
So the first person said it's all in your mind, and you said next.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
And so the next clinic I went to, the gentleman, every time I would go in, he would put me in an anechoic chamber, test my hearing, and then do the old thing, pump up the pressure on the ears and check the pressure against the eardrums. And one day I went in there, and he said, well, okay, we found some fluid in the inner ear and put in a small stent, a small pressure relief valve, and that worked pretty good for a while until the eardrum healed and popped the thing out. So the next thing he suggested is that I do quite often during the day that Valsalva maneuver where I, you know, hold my nose and put pressure and kind of clear the eustachian tubes, and then prescribed a pressure bottle for me where you use the prepackaged baking powder and salt in a buffered solution.
So you've done everything. that you can possibly do. I mean, that's basically, from a medical point of view, you've been blowing your nose to open your eustachian tube. You've been using a saline solution to clear out your nose.
Right.
You've had steroid nasal sprays. You've had antibiotics. You've had a psychiatric look at this is all in your head, and there's nothing actually there, and you've seen three doctors.
Yes.
Now, you're expecting that I can solve this problem.
Yeah, number four. Yeah.
In other words, I'm doctor number four. I'm on the radio. Yeah. I have to put on my thinking cap.
Yeah.
I'm going to solve the problem.
So, come on, Miracle Man.
Come on, Miracle Man. In other words, show it to me. Where's the beef? Show me the money. That's it. Where's the beef?
Right,
show me the money.
Right.
I'm going to go through the radio waves, and I'm going to go to the ears, and I'm going to solve it.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you some advice that
Good.
The others haven't given you.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what that advice is?
No.
Not everything is open to medicine to be cured, or do we understand? And that's the best advice I can give you. We know that the tube between the nose and the ears, the eustachian tube that you talked about, gets swollen, and then the middle ear doesn't ventilate the right way, and we feel like there's fluid in there. The treatment is antibiotics to get rid of the fluid, steroids to get rid of the fluid. The only thing he hasn't done is have tubes put in his ears, which is a possibility. No, it's not a bad surgery. Little tubes in the ears, sometimes that will work with people. And that is about it. There's some theory that some people who have this chronic problem have a fungi that actually grows within the back of the nose and the ears, and that's a theory right now. No one has proven this. But at this time, you have received maximal medical therapy, and that's as good as it gets.
Yeah.
It doesn't get to anything else. So I recommend you go to an alternative practitioner. I would look at acupuncture. I would go and I would look at Rolfing of the neck. This is a type of massage in the neck that may actually improve this.
Huh.
This is a very good example where complementary medicine, I would go to a naturopath and I would look at what you're eating.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also go to somebody who specializes in aromatherapy.
Huh.
This is a very, very good example of where alternative medicine may make a difference. I would also consider yoga because there are some yoga positions that might actually help you. That's what I would do. I would stay away from other Western medicine. I don't think it's going to do anything at all. So,
thank you for calling us at 800-462-7413. Zorba, let's check the Zorba Pester on your health inbox and take an email now from Len in Duluth, Minnesota. He writes, I am a healthy 63-year-old male. I would like to grow a beard to cover some of the wrinkles I am getting. However, I never really was able to grow much facial hair. With the advancements in hormone therapy, is there anything a person my age, and again that's 63, can do to stimulate facial hair growth?
Absolutely not.
Huh?
There's absolutely nothing you can do. Now, if you want to get rid of facial hair, I might take that back. There are a few things. First of all, if you want to get rid of facial hair, which you don't
want to
do, you take estrogens, and that'll get rid of facial hair.
He wants to grow.
Yeah, he wants to grow. But I thought I'd tell those people who want to get rid of facial hair, in your male, large doses of estrogens will get rid of facial hair. It'll change other parts of your body also.
Yeah.
But you will get facial hair. You'll get rid of facial hair. There's nothing that grows hair that we know of.
Yeah, but
there really isn't anything.
Here's the answer to this gentleman.
Yes, okay.
I mean, look at me.
Yeah, I'm looking
at you. I don't have much of a beard,
yeah,
but I do have a beard.
That's right.
And look how handsome
I
am.
Absolutely.
So why bother to want to grow more facial hair?
Go to our website, look at Tom.
Yeah.
And if you want to be handsome like Tom, you can do what?
Just grow your beard.
Just grow a
beard. And don't worry about the fact that it's a very light beard. Very light beard.
So change
with an elderly gentleman such as myself can be very, very beautiful, right?
Right. Right. We'll leave that as right, won't we?
We like hearing from you, whether we can solve your problem or not. Just send us an email.
And we can't solve them all.
Just send us an email with your comments, questions, and tips, too.
Zorba at WPR.org.
A yummy recipe coming up. More of your questions. We have our medical myth buster and some more research, too. Lots of good reasons to stay tuned here to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. From PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our phone number, if you have a question for Zorba, 1-800-462-7413. Give us a call. Zorba will help you. 800-462-7413 is that number to call. But right now, before our next caller, my mouth is watering because sitting right next to me and Zorba sitting right next to you, we have a serving courtesy of our producer, Adam Friedrich, of the delicious garlic mustard potatoes.
That's right. This is the opposite of a tofu recipe. On the spectrum, this is the exact opposite. Your mouth would not water if you were sitting next to a nice chunk of tofu.
Bingo.
That's right. Bingo. Okay. Great recipe, wonderful recipe. Potato, sometimes it is the maligned vegetable. It is a great vegetable. Once again, in the U.S., the issue is not the veggie that we use, but the mass of the amount of the veggies that we take.
Yeah.
And when you're thinking of potatoes, do not think of fried. You know, I like my French fries, but you don't want to eat them every day because they are not good for you.
Mm-hmm.
So start out with 1.5 pounds of small reds.
Yeah. Halved, right?
That's right.
I'm looking over
now,
here.
Now, you can, of course, use Yukon Gold, which is a very creamy potato. You can, of course, use an Idaho, which is a wonderful potato, and cut this into chunks if you want to. Wonderful potatoes, the Idahos. I happen to like reds because they're creamy.
I agree with you.
I like reds. That's my preference. But any potato will be good.
Mm-hmm.
The main thing is the potato has to be fresh. A lot of times we put potatoes in our drawers. We let them sit there. We let them sprout. They do not taste as good. So a nice, fresh, red potato, small potato.
To wait until we're done to
yes,
eat
you
the,
do. Oh, yes, you do.
All right,
yes, you do.
Let's,
keep your hands
hurry,
away
hurry it up
from
a little
that.
Then,
three
please.
Tablespoonfuls of extra virgin olive oil.
Three big tea extra virgin
That's
olive
right.
oil.
Now, I love my extra virgins. I now buy it. I try a variety of extra virgin olive oil. I tend to buy it now through the internet. I have a wonderful company that I have used out in California that this year won the Los Angeles Olive Oil Award, and they sent me an email, do you want to buy some more gallons? And I bought 2 more gallons from the Los Angeles Olive Oil Award. So if you go to our website where we have great references, you can find how to get some great olive oil. Well, we'll promote a lot of companies.
Oh.
3 tablespoons of Dijon mustard.
3 big tea Dijon
That's
mustard.
Right, Dijon mustard, which is great. 3 cloves of garlic minced.
3 cloves of minced garlic.
Is your mouth watering now?
It was
yes.
so already.
Yes. But once it gets to garlic, it really waters. 1.5 tablespoons.
Well, they're sitting right here.
Yes, they are. Finely chopped rosemaries.
1.5 big tea. Finely chopped rosemary.
Right, so you've got to take the rosemary that's there. If you can and chop it, you can use rosemary straight out of the container. If you chop it, it'll be smaller, which is better.
This is these little things
called rosemary.
Yeah, okay.
That's
okay,
right, rosemary.
Yeah,
there, right. Rosemary, which is from a plant. It's like it's from a rosemary plant. That's what it's from. 1.5 teaspoon of cayenne pepper. Don't test my brain.
Write that down. From the rosemary,
rosemary plant. That's right. One half teaspoon of cayenne pepper.
1/2 little tea cayenne pepper.
It's like who's buried in Grant's tomb.
Yeah, right.
Where does rosemary come from? Where does basil come from? Where does thyme come from? Where does pepper come from? 1.5 teaspoon of cayenne pepper.
Where are we?
We're back on cayenne pepper again. I'm stuck there.
We did that already.
I know, but I did it again.
All right.
1/2 teaspoon of kosher salt.
1/2 little tea kosher
salt. It's chunkier. You can use sea salt, too. It's better than regular salt because it's chunkier. It has a different taste to it. It has a larger crystal, so it tastes saltier, and I like that.
Okay.
1/2 teaspoon of fresh ground black pepper.
1/2 little tea. Fresh ground black pepper.
So let's make it.
Mm-hmm.
So line the baking sheet with heavy foil. You've got to go to the store and get some heavy foil.
I know
you're eating. In a large pot, boil the potatoes in salted water. Put a little salt in the water until tender. That's about 10 minutes. So tender but not mushy. Drain it and cool it. Now while the potatoes cool, whisk the olive oil, mustard, garlic cloves. Put in then the pepper and salt and rosemary in a large bowl until it's just about, you know, taste it and see what it's like. How do you like the taste of it?
Delicious. You've outdone yourself.
Your eyes are rolling. Then add the potatoes to this nice dressing mix. Toss it to coat it. Now place it on the baking sheet, okay? The baking sheet that's got that nice heavy aluminum foil. Heavy aluminum foil is better. Preheat the broiler. Okay, and then place the baking sheet 6 inches from the heat source and broil those potatoes for 5 minutes. So you're putting them into a sort of a hot oven, but it's underneath that broiler. Broil it for 5 minutes. Turn it and broil it an additional 5 minutes, and you're done. And serve it, and it's really delicious.
This
Would
so
you
good.
Please hand that over so I can have a piece?
Oh, I thought you had your own.
No, I don't have my own. You're hoarding the whole thing.
Too bad.
I want some.
You know
some.
What it tastes like.
I know what I want some. I want some.
Let Adam know how he did.
I want
your
some.
Your protege.
Oh, my gosh. You've outdone yourself. This is so good. Mm. And you can pre-deheat these. By the way, you can pre-make them. And then just before you serve them, you can microwave them. Mm. Mm.
Well, that's what Adam did, right? In order to get them to us.
I know. We don't have
can
a broiler
at our website.
Can you
pass it back, please?
I'll take another piece. This is great. What a great lunch dish. Mm. I love it.
And you can serve this as a side dish?
Yes. It's served as a side dish, as a main dish. It has nice spice to it. Calories are 158 calories, not many calories. Low in fat. 7 grams of fat. The issue about fat, this is good oil. This is extra virgin olive oil. It's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Let us send you this recipe. Address your request to Zorba Pastor on Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, zip 53706. Be sure to enclose, though, a self-addressed stamped business-sized envelope so we can send it back to you.
You can also get this on our website at zorbapastor.org and download the recipe yourself and simply print it up on your printer. Or you can get a podcast of our recipe on our website and our other recipes, our podcast, too. It's a great way to listen to Tom and I over and over and over again.
Oh, yeah, that really sounds interesting. Everybody wants to do that.
There we go.
(800) 462-7413 is our toll-free number. And a listener with us now in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Hi.
Hey, how you doing today?
Fine. Thanks for wading through the recipe. Sounded good, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. Sounds lovely. You can eat the potatoes.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, you know, they're kind of high in carbohydrates, and I try to avoid them as much as possible.
No, but potatoes are good. Avoiding them is not necessary. It's taking the amount that you're eating. So, for instance, here we have 1.5 pounds of potatoes. We've used a minimal amount of oil. Very, very useful. The issue is when you start eating mounds of potatoes, or if you look at the way most potatoes are eaten in this country, as a French fry, that's the issue. Potatoes are wonderful vegetables. They should not be avoided.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, how can we help you?
Yeah, I had a question. I'm a type 2 diabetic. And, you know, of course, about a year ago I was diagnosed. I had an A1C of 14.7, if you know what that is. My last A1C was 5.4.
Okay, now I've got to explain it to people who are not diabetics. Hemoglobin A1C is a batting average. It's a measurement of what your blood sugar is. The goal is to drop it below the number 7. 5.4 is really the average of typical person in America who does not have diabetes is in the middle of the 5 range. It certainly is sort of in the early 6 range. A hemoglobin A1C that is double digits is bad. In other words, it's really significantly bad. So how did you drop? That means your blood sugar was averaging about 400 probably.
Yeah,
when you were
that's correct. Well, of course, diet was one of the main things. I am on medication, mm-hmm. but also diet. And then I also
and exercise.
Started... and exercise, correct. Diet, medication, exercise. You know, my question was, also I started using cinnamon in my coffee. And what I do is I take a cinnamon stick, because I had heard that cinnamon, you know, helped you to use your insulin more efficiently that your pancreas is producing. And I had heard it on a news channel, and I was just kind of curious, is there any truth to that?
I don't think there's any evidence that I've ever seen that cinnamon, for some reason...
But it was on the news channel.
Yeah, it's on the news channel, right, so
it must be true.
For some reason, cinnamon, I don't know if it's the cinnamon producers or a book, Cinnamon, Your Key to a Long, Sweet Life. But for some reason, there's been more interest in cinnamon in the last year than anything else that I've seen in the alternative medical press. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of interest in cinnamon and does it do good or not do good. And I don't think there's any evidence that cinnamon helps your body metabolize and use the insulin better. I do want to tell you, though, what there is very good evidence for. Using your muscles with exercise undoubtedly improves control, because when you move your muscles, your body does metabolize it. It uses its insulin better. And that really has been shown absolutely to be the case. So, for instance, when we first started chatting, you said, you know, medications and diet. You've been watching what you're eating. And that, of course, is crucially important. But a diabetic who is in good control, the control that you have, also should it must be exercising. And I take it that you're doing some exercise every day. Is that the case or not the case?
Yes, sir. I do work out. I try to ride my bicycle from time to time. Not every day, unfortunately. I do travel on the road quite a bit, which sometimes is very difficult on my diet.
I recommend that you get a pedometer, and I'll tell you why. 10,000 steps a day is what you need to do. And when you're on the road, you've got to do it even more because, as you mentioned, your diet is not the same. It's not as good. So you got to put your little pedometer on. And if you're on the road, you're working, and you realize, hey, I've only done 6,000 steps, you got to get out and do those 10,000 steps every single day as a diabetic. It's extremely important. Doesn't mean you have to go to the gym. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean you have to do something else, but it's 10,000 steps a day as a diabetic is going to improve your life dramatically because it's going to improve your insulin, your essentially how your body metabolizes
but
insulin.
But don't count on the cinnamon.
Do not count on the cinnamon, no. Although I do like cinnamon sometimes during this time of year, you know, a little mulled wine with some cinnamon. That's something I would count on for that.
Thanks for calling. 800-462-7413. A listener now, Zorba, in Dallas, Texas. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
I've experienced a problem since early ages of life, about, you know, 10 years old and up. I'm currently 23, and what the problem is after drinking certain beverages, you know, like Hawaiian Punch, certain sodas or whatnot, I get a horrible aching sensation, well past heartburn or anything else I've ever experienced. Hmm. My father also experiences this problem, so I don't know if it's hereditary or what, but I've never been able to find out what exactly it is that's causing it, what chemical or dye or what.
Does it happen with all kinds of soda or just certain sorts of soda?
Just depends, really. Sometimes Coke will do it. A cola will, but you
haven't noticed that it happens more often with caffeinated as opposed to non-caffeinated, or
it's not really any caffeinated over anything else.
Yeah.
Okay, one of the things that's happening is you're talking about drinks that are high fructose corn syrup drinks. You know, you look at Hawaiian Punch, that defines a high fructose corn syrup drink. And what will happen is sometimes you'll get esophageal spasm when you drink that. And this may be esophageal spasm. And there's a way to treat esophageal spasm when it's bad, and it's nitroglycerin. It's nitro. It's what we give for angina, and you put it under your tongue, and it treats the esophageal spasm. Now, I'm not recommending you put a nitro under your tongue that we give for angina, and then you drink.
Sounds a little extreme for a, you know.
Hey, but if you're addicted to Hawaiian Punch, you got to do, a guy's got to do what a guy's got to do to drink that Hawaiian Punch. But that's what this sounds like. It sounds like esophageal spasm. And for people who have it, sometimes it's spicy drinks, it's sugary drinks, it's hot food. Sometimes it's the speed of swallowing. If you really guzzle it down very quickly, it'll do it. And in fact, at some point, we've all had esophageal spasm, and it's because it's high fructose corn syrup. And if you're drinking 20 ounces, you're getting the equivalent of 20 teaspoons of sugar in your body during that time. So recommendation is go to the drinks that you like that do not have the same amount of high fructose. If you go to something such as club soda with a little bit of lemon in there, you will not have those number of calories that nobody needs. Right. Talk about empty calories. High fructose corn syrup is a good example of empty calories. And that's what it is. It's esophageal spasm. It's awful. It's very, very painful. And as I said, the solution obviously is to drink something different or to drink it over time.
Yes. Yeah. Are you really suggesting or not suggesting the possibility of the nitrogen?
Well, no. Nitroglycerin, not nitrogen. Well, what happens is some people have great trouble with esophageal spasm even when they sit down for a meal. In other words, they can't sit down for a normal meal and they get spasm. For those people, we give them nitro to put under their tongue. But for someone like this, my recommendation is stay away from the foods that cause it. And when we're talking about Hawaiian Punch, Hawaiian Punch is not what I call a how do I put it? Nutritionally responsible, healthy drink.
So there is a difference between nitrogen and nitroglycerin, right?
Yes, this is not nitrogen. This is nitroglycerin.
800-462-7413. A question now, Zorba, from our inbox. It comes to us from Wayne in Boulder, Colorado. But Wayne is a transplant from Shawnee, Wisconsin. He writes, before moving to Boulder a few years ago, I had my blood pressure taken, and it was 118 over 75. When I took it again here in Colorado, it had raised to 150 over 95. I've been on HTZ since, But when I come back
that,
to it.
Now, that's a HCTZ is a blood pressure pill, which is a diuretic.
Okay. But when I come back to Wisconsin every year to ski in the Berkey, it really drops. Could the altitude there in Colorado be causing my high blood pressure? Or is my body missing the cheese and brats?
Oh, the body's missing the cheese and brats. That's clear. That's clearly.
But does altitude?
No,
have
the,
any effect?
The altitude may actually
oh, it
may
really
actually
does.
Be. You bet. So he may have high blood pressure at a higher altitude, and at the non higher altitude, he's not. Now, when you're in the Berkey, which is the Birkebeiner, which is this big cross country race, you're exercising, and your pressure will go down with exercise. So if he's a couch potato in Colorado,
which could be,
and he's an exerciser in Wisconsin, this may be the exercise issue. And the simple way to do that is to engage in as much exercise in Colorado, measure your pressure and see if it's there. My guess, this is related to the altitude.
Ah, so the high blood pressure medicine probably
right.
He'll
right.
have
so the
to
answer
continue.
Is move back to Wisconsin, get your beer, get your cheese, get your brats. You'll be just fine.
That's pretty interesting.
Yes, it is.
Well, no matter what your BP is, we want to hear from you. Just send us an email with your question, tip, or comment to
Zorba@WPR.org.
And more of your calls coming up along with our medical myth buster here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Again, that number, 800-462-7413, and we will be taking some more calls before we're out of time. But time now, Zorba, to get to that topic you mentioned earlier. We've talked about circumcision a number of times on this
right.
program, but
right.
this is some really interesting news regarding circumcision.
Right. Now, when we look at circumcision for many, many years, we've talked about the fact that it really is a cultural issue. It is certainly a cultural issue for many, many cultures. Circumcision is widely practiced in America. About 80% of all the boys are circumcised. In Europe, it's about 20% that are
But we've had no real clear health reason to or not to circumcise up until now.
Right. In Africa, there was a study that looked at men who were circumcised. In Africa, HIV is a scourge. It's a scourge all over, but it's a special scourge in Africa, especially in studies such as Uganda and Kenya. And what they did was they had a study. Obviously, it was not a double-blind placebo-controlled study because right. you can tell if you're circumcised or not.
Right.
But they compared men who came in and either got circumcised at birth or they got circumcised after birth when they were young men, two men who were not circumcised. And it appears that when you are circumcised, you cut the risk of getting the AIDS virus through heterosexual intercourse
no,
by 50%.
Well, that's I was going to make a joke, which we wouldn't
this
have. No, no pun intended with
this,
that cutting.
This is a biggie. And the link between male circumcision and HIV prevention was noted really back in the 1980s. But this is the first major clinical trial of men in Uganda and Kenya. There was a trial recently also of 3,000 men in South Africa last year. And in the South African trial, they found that circumcision reduced the HIV risk of transmission by 60%. So this is a huge issue. This is a huge issue. It may be that the HIV virus is actually living underneath the foreskin, between the foreskin and between the glands.
And penis. Again, the circumcision could cut the risk of AIDS in half.
Right. That's an incredible thing. Now, of course, you cut the risk dramatically by wearing a condom, and it's not that circumcision is the answer. It's still not as good as a condom by any stretch of the imagination. But the issue, especially in Africa and in other places, is condoms aren't used for a whole bunch of reasons, from a cultural point of view to a sensitivity point of view to just the availability and the expense of condoms.
And condom technology is really progressing as well.
Well, condom technology and the ability for women to protect themselves as progressing, because women douching themselves essentially with these different chemicals to try to reduce HIV transmission is another big issue that's theirs, and this is on the horizon. But the circumcision, bringing it back to this, is a big issue. Condoms are still the most important way to reduce it, but we may find that there now is a reason to actually have men engage in circumcision, and this reason may be the reduction in HIV. This is a great study.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. That's 1-800-462-7413. A listener with us now, Zorba, in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello. How are you guys doing?
Fine. How can we help you?
All right. I just have a quick question. Mm-hmm. I've been having a lot of problems with my tonsils lately. Since like the second week of school, I became really sick, and they told me that I had non-strep tonsillitis. And basically, my tonsils haven't gone down in size since I was sick. Mm. And they put me on antibiotics 3 different times. And I'm going out of the country to Guatemala, actually, in a few weeks. And I'm really my parents are really worried that I am going to become even more sick.
Uh-huh. Well, now, are you going to Guatemala for a week or two, you mean, or are you going for a year?
For 2 weeks.
Uh-huh. Well, first of all, you've got a long-term issue and a short-term issue. The size of your tonsils may never go down, and there's nothing wrong with having large, generous tonsils. Some people have small tonsils. We do not take out tonsils because of their size. If you have a proven infection, such as strep, and that is the proven infection, and it recurs, then there are certain guidelines of when you get your tonsils removed. And it has to be not a viral infection. It really has to be strep-proven tonsillitis. Did you have strep tonsillitis, or did
you? No, they took a test and they said that it was non-strep. So
do you live in a dorm?
Also,
you live in a house, or you live in a dorm?
Yeah, I live in the dorm.
Uh-huh. You live in the dorm, and what happens is you're in the dorm, and there are a lot of other people that get sick in the dorm, and you're in close contact with lots of people. It's common to get dorm infections, and what I would do if you're concerned is speak to your physician and just stay on antibiotics while you're traveling for 2 weeks. That's what I would do. I would just stay on antibiotics. What I would do is I would probably get azithromycin called Zithromax, and azithromycin, if you take 500 milligrams daily for 5 days before you go, when you're first going there, it really gives a nice blood level and it'll stay in your body for 2 weeks. And that's what I would do. But the size of your tonsils really doesn't really mean anything. It's strep proven tonsillitis that means something. And you're in a dorm, kids in the dorm, they always get infections all the time.
Yeah.
As soon as they leave the dorm, they get fewer infections.
But even if it's not strep, if she keeps getting sick, why not just pull them out?
Well, that's the 1950s view. If you're just getting sick, why not pull them out? Because a lot of people still get sick and they still get sore throats.
Well, even after they're out.
You bet. Now, if they have strep proven tonsillitis,
right,
and they have more than 3 in a year, for instance, and especially if they have them proven negative in between, in other words, they get rid of strep infection 3 to 4 a year, mm-hmm, then that's a reason. And there's certain guidelines that are really looked at by the National Institute of Health that when you remove your tonsils, and the reason is some people die of tonsillectomies. They bleed from tonsillectomies. It's painful. Mm-hmm. It's expensive. It's still a common procedure, and you don't just do it willy-nilly, and then people still can get infections. For instance, she lives in the dorm. If she stays in the dorm, she's still going to get infections from other kids in the dorm because, once again, they're around each other and it spreads . It's a dorm condition. So,
thank you for the call.
Good luck and have fun in Guatemala.
Time now, Zorba, for our medical myth buster. Today's myth might be suited for our producer and party animal engineer. It has to do with hangovers. Do certain kinds of alcohol make hangovers worse?
The answer is, what do you think, Tom?
Yes.
The answer is yes.
Oh, it is.
That's exactly
good,
right.
Guess. Good
the
guess.
Answer is yes. You know, we used to say that alcohol is alcohol is alcohol,
yeah,
from a point of view of hangovers, but it doesn't seem to be that way. It appears that there are things called cogeners. Cogeners are the other things that are produced when you're actually distilling the liquor. These, mm-hmm, are complex organic molecules, things such as methanol that are actually produced when you're doing it. And the more cogeners you have of a certain type, the more likely you are to have a hangover. So, for instance, cheap vodka or moonshine, which has lots more cogeners, is more likely to produce essentially a hangover. Now, the British Medical Journal had a study a number of years ago. Mm. They looked at different kinds of alcohol, and what they found was that hangovers were most likely caused by Brandy, which, by the way, is the drink of choice in the state of Wisconsin, after beer. After beer. Brandy followed by red wine, rum, whiskey, white wine, gin, and vodka. In other words, vodka of those spirits was actually the least likely. Another study showed that bourbon was twice as likely to cause a hangover than the same amount of vodka. So it's very interesting. It appears that vodka, good vodka, not cheap vodka.
Yeah.
Not, you know, you're smiling.
You're in
but
trouble.
I know,
you're in trouble, Zorba.
But I know the type of cheap vodka that you drink, Tom. I've seen you slam down those vodka spirits. But cheap vodka is more likely to cause a hangover than expensive vodka. And brandy is more likely to cause a hangover, for instance, than white wine. So, yeah, the type of alcohol.
It does matter.
So, yeah, you know, that brings up another myth, this idea that you shouldn't mix different kinds of alcohol when you're drinking because you're more likely to have a hangover. And it might not be that mixing the different type of alcohol is not as important.
Some of the mix may be the kind
right,
that are worse.
Right,
yeah.
It might be that, you know, you stick with it's because of the other alcohol that you're mixing in that makes it more likely that you're going to have that hangover. Another myth. Dispelled.
I haven't had vodka, cheap or expensive, in 30 years.
In 30 years,
40
so you're
years?
Not a vodka. Now, I have occasionally had Stoli, you know, which is that expensive Russian vodka.
Yeah.
You know, go over to my cousin's house. I'm not big at drinking something other than wine and an occasional beer. But I have had it in the freezer, and I've had this little aperitif, and it doesn't give me it doesn't give me a hangover. But I only have one drink. So,
Well, if you have a myth you'd like Zorba to bust, just send us an email. Although we'd prefer if you weren't hungover, just send that email. To
Zorba@WPR.org.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And a listener with us now, Zorba, in Suttons Bay, Michigan. Hi.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine.
Wonderful. I love the show, and I'm a first-time caller, and I'm just delighted to be able to get through and talk to both of you.
Oh, well, great. We're glad to have you with us here.
Yes.
How can we help you?
Well, I have a skin condition that has been diagnosed called lichen planus. And as far as I have been told by dermatologists and my GP, they don't know what causes it. There is no known cure.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that is really annoying about it is the fact that it's incredibly itchy.
Well, now Zorba will tell you what causes it, how to cure it, and so you'll never have to itch again.
Thank you.
Right, from your mouth to God's ears. Wouldn't that be wonderful? You know, it's interesting. You would think Tom was a dermatologist. We don't know what causes lichen planus. That's the first thing I want to tell you, so I won't tell you what causes it. It's a chronic disease, so I can't tell you the cure, but I can give you some advice on how to make your life better. But wait a second. Now, you've looked on the web about lichen planus, right? Who doesn't go to the web? In fact, I have to tell you.
I don't.
Tom doesn't go to the web. Who doesn't go to the web? Tom raises his hand right away, first in the class. I don't go to the web. Well, other than a few of the outliers, you know, a few of the people who are the Luddites, most of us end up going to the web. You know, web is number two. Do you know what number one is on the web? Well, we won't even talk about number one.
No.
We
Everybody
can
knows.
Imagine what number one is. Right. So you went to the web, and what'd you find on the web?
I went to several different sites, but mainly the one for Dermatologists Association.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out different things. I found out that it may be related to liver function.
Uh-huh.
So I did have my liver function checked.
Right. There are certain things that you do. It's chronic. You know, it tends to recur.
Yes.
But for many people, steroid creams work very well. Have you put steroid creams on your hands at all because it bothers you?
I have used steroid creams. Mm-hmm. I have been on a course of
Of oral steroids,
yes.
Did that do anything at all?
It did. It took care of the situation for about 2 weeks.
Right.
And then it began to recur.
Mm-hmm. What do the creams do when you put the creams on your hand?
It does tend to sort of take some of the itching away temporarily, but inevitably it comes back. I use hydrocortisone. I use, things that have menthol in them.
Right. Have you used a stronger cream than hydrocortisone?
I was given a prescription for a topical steroid called Luxeek, but it's $185 an ounce.
Okay, I've got $185 an ounce. That's more, about half the price of gold. I've got a couple of suggestions. First of all, there is a cheap, inexpensive, generic steroid cream that dermatologists used for years, and it's the number one cream. It's called Triamcinolone, T-R-I-A-M-C-I-N-A-L-O-N-E. Big, long word. Initials are TMC. Every pharmacist knows what that is. TMC 0.1% cream and ointment. I would recommend you get 2 ounces of each. Probably cost you $30. You know, 2 ounces might be $20. It's very, very, very inexpensive. And what you do during the day is you put it on 2 to 3 times during the day. At night, you put the ointment on. You put white gloves, you know, nice gardening gloves, white because kind of looks nicer than brown, on your hands because it increases the absorption of the cream at night if you can take the ointment. Some people like ointment. Some people don't. They find it tacky. Get it under control that way. When you do, then you start using the Triamcinolone cream lesser and lesser and lesser until maybe you're using it every day or every other day. And you begin to substitute another cream, which is also cheap. And this is not over-the-counter hydrocortisone cream. It's hydrocortisone cream, 2.5%. Prescription only, you can get 2 to 4 ounces probably for $5. And that's what you use during the day. And for a lot of people, if they go to the hydrocortisone 2.5%, which they can use for years, they can get this under control. But you need a cheap generic, and you ought to call your doctor. Call your family doctor and say, I want to try the Triamcinolone cream. Don't go for the expensive stuff. Try the cheap stuff. I like cheap. When it works, it's better.
Thanks a lot for the call. 800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. That's 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, time for a quick question from Bob in Tallahassee, Florida. Bob would like to know if blood is used to make a tetanus shot. He lives in a wooded area where it's not uncommon to step on a nail or get hooked by a barbed wire, and he's not so sure he wants to get a tetanus shot if there's blood involved.
There's no blood involved in making a tetanus shot at all. No blood at all. It's something that's manufactured. It is not a blood-borne product.
Ah, he'll be happy to hear that. There's definitely no blood involved with sending us your comments and questions. Send us an email to
Zorba at WPR.org.
Zorba, we'll see you next week.
A pleasure, Tom.
For a copy of this week's recipe and all things Zorba, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org.
And don't forget, our producer is available anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director, and Gigi Holland fills your recipe requests. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0105Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.